to your Right to Speak discussions on child and youth rights and advocacy. This is episode 19, and I'm your host, Salvatore.
And I'm Jen.
On today's episode, we continue our topic on immigration and refugees. We'll be talking with Professor Dagmar Sonneken. I'm very excited to have her on the show today. I know that me and Jen are both a little bit green on this topic, and I think we're excited to learn a lot today. So, Professor Sonneken, would you please introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name is Dagmar Sonneken, and I'm a professor in the School of Public Policy and Administration at York University. I'm also cross-appointed to the Department of Social Science in the Law and Society program at York. And yes, indeed, I am also the director of our master's program in Public Policy, Administration, and Law.
So thank you, Professor. I guess we're just going to dive right into the show. I guess I'll ask the first question that we have on our list. Can you define what a refugee is, or what the meaning of refugee is?
There are two important norms that govern who a refugee is. First of all, there is an international definition that comes out of World War II, and that's in the 1951 Geneva Convention. And that definition is pretty much incorporated into Canadian law in the Immigration Refugee Protection Act. And it's important to talk about this because there are also differences between the two in terms of the scope of the protection. Because classically, after World War II, a refugee was somebody who was running away from interstate war and who was fearing for his or her life, and they were running away because they were being persecuted, right? Mm-hmm. And you think about a refugee after the war as classically a Jewish person, a gay or a lesbian person, perhaps a Roma, but in the classic definition of a refugee, political persecution. So if you had opposite political views was also something that was considered a classic ground for persecution. And then there are the social grounds, religion, ethnicity, there's a whole shopping list. And actually, since we're talking about World War II, the definition really is tied to states fighting each other and to people being able to leave the territory of that state. That's critical because there are a lot of people around the world that we often casually talk about as refugees, but in international law, they would be considered displaced persons because they're still within their country of origin. So in order for the classic and technical definition of a refugee to apply, you actually have to have made it outside of that country. And that's, of course, already hugely difficult if you think about some of the country zones, if you think about Syria. So if you are in Turkey, then you have made it outside of the country, but there's still so many people in Syria, but technically they are not refugees under international law yet, right? They're just victims of a horrible conflict gone wrong. But this is also then directly about the process of how you would apply to have this refugee status recognized by another state. So this is connected to the definition, but it's also very much connected to who recognizes a refugee in law.
So do you find that sometimes with the definition and the technicalities, it causes, I guess, gaps within the system?
I'm nodding, which people, of course, can't see. But I think it's the technicalities are part of it because a legal definition and a right to be protected and to not be returned to that country where you might face death or torture, which is also part of the definition. So for the ground that you're being granted protection under assumes that you're safe from this persecution and protection. But of course, it creates all sorts of boundaries because somebody has to interpret the situation in that country. There are national interests at stake. As I was already explaining, you have to leave your country of origin to even apply. Some countries don't let people leave. There are personal circumstances why your grandmother might not have been able to leave or wanted to leave, right? And then if it's a conflict where a state is breaking down, like in Syria, in Afghanistan, in some of the Latin American states where it's more interstate action or war, or where the Taliban, for example, in Afghanistan are suddenly the authority in the state, because the old definition, the gap is that it was very much tied to the rule of the state.
Right.
And a lot of countries that didn't want refugees then said, well, you weren't really persecuted by a state. You were persecuted by the Taliban, but, you know, they aren't a state. So the gap then is Canada then said, okay, they're state-like actors, but there were other countries around the world that said, okay, we're going to stick with the old interpretation and we're not going to expand. Same with what are social grounds of protection. So if you were a gay or a lesbian being persecuted for your sexual orientation, that did not become a ground for protection until quite recently. Because again, even though I would argue in World War II, they were all classically persecuted, but that still had not made its way into jurisprudence. So the gap is also what we consider social norms still also needed to filter into what people were claiming. So somebody needed to step up, and then the jurisprudence needed to take place. So the gaps are in the process, but also in the way that the definition was created. And yeah, I think it's hugely confusing because the term gets talked about in a lot of positive, negative context. Mm-hmm. There's a difference in Europe. The word asylum seeker gets talked about there. In the US, refugee means something else than asylum seeker. So the categories never help any.
And thank you for clarifying that. It sounds like it's a multifaceted, I guess, issue, if I could label it as that. So thank you again for clarifying it. I know the listeners are appreciating that. Jen, would you like to go on to...
Yeah, for sure. I know, like, we've talked about, like, what a refugee is, like, by definition, and I feel sometimes that makes them, like, a statistic or, like, a number, and how would you, I guess, describe that to make... Like, how would you explain what a refugee is, like, as a person, instead of just a statistic?
I think the most important thing to remember is that a refugee is just like you and me and the average person. It's just that they happen to have found themselves in a country, in a situation where their life just suddenly went to hell, and that could be because they happen to belong to the wrong religion, to the wrong ethnicity. Suddenly people in power were fighting, and again, I'm German, to go into my country's history, suddenly they found out that they were the people with the yellow star who somebody wanted to exterminate. Right, so it's really, if you look at history around the world, there are little children that then are being persecuted just again due to their religion, due to the fact that they belong to a family who has certain political leanings. And so I think it's really important to say they're no different than we are, and they're in just urgent need of help because their world is collapsing and they need our protection.
I think that's such a good point, because often what has happened is, I guess, there's a certain label that comes with refugees, and the average person has a certain perception of what a refugee looks like. So I think it's great from what your last point said, is they're no different from you and us. I think that's a huge light bulb moment for a lot of people. How would you describe, I just want to touch on what your thoughts are on what you think the average person's perception of when they hear the word refugee.
It's interesting that you use the word average person, because of course you're asking a social scientist to say, well, what is the average person, right? Are we talking about the average Canadian? Are we talking about the average American? Are we talking about the average German? And then what do we statistically consider average, right? And then are you talking about, are people sympathetic towards the plight, which is a very abstract question, or are they sympathetic and willing to take people in and thereby share resources, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to break that down and then look at what people say. And I think it's interesting that in the current situation, how compassionate people in countries are that have traditionally not been quite so compassionate, and how it's also flipped around. And by that, because I study comparative public policy, and because I happen to have lived half of my life in Europe and the other half of my life in Canada, I find it fascinating that in Canada, under the last government, there was a lot of suspicion, a lot of casting refugees as the other, as the people who we should all associate with terrorism, and they suddenly all became suspect, while Canada has, and this is not a sudden question, and we could talk about the transition, but really it was sort of the peak moment of the security suspicion of a group of people that also happened to be Muslim, and so the associations there were very clear, and so Canada's commitment, historic commitment to take people, that was supported by the public, and this is where I'm getting at public perceptions, I'm getting back to that, the perception was shared that we should be suspicious. And if you then go across the Atlantic to Germany, my other home, there we had suddenly the opposite reaction. And I think a lot of us, scholars of comparative politics and public policy, especially scholars of Germany, are still puzzled by that. Because in the 1990s, with the Kosovo War, there were people fleeing Yugoslavia, and there were terrible things that happened there. And I think people were sympathetic, but not to the same extent. So I think where public opinion is, it's really interesting how it's hard to pin down sometimes why in one country people suddenly open their arms and say, yes, we do want this, because the German public is still overwhelmingly supportive, although skepticism is growing. But volunteerism, again, I'm looking for measures of perception, right? Volunteerism in Germany has skyrocketed, and I have some colleagues in Germany who are working on how involved people have become since the arrival of Syrian refugees. And I know in Canada, especially on the York campus, the initiatives to sponsor Syrians has also skyrocketed. And I think the sympathy is back. Of course, there's a different government that's also spreading the message of sympathy, but what, again, I could measure just by university activism, I would say, and of course we're at a left-leaning university, there is a lot of buzz and a lot of activism. So perceptions, I think there's always a lot of education involved in talking to people, but I was surprised the last time I was in Germany, I was in a pedestrian zone, everybody was talking about what was going on. People in my parents' generation were remembering their flight from other countries, because you would remember that in Germany, the people that would be my parents' generation, they might have been children, or maybe they were teenagers when World War II broke out. So I was surprised to hear that, again, in terms of common on the street perception. But of course, there's also that fear of the other, of the unknown, of the people you don't haven't associated with. And that would be the same in small-town Canada as it would be somewhere in small town Germany, right? So again, perception is a layered thing that we need to unpack quite a bit. But it is very powerful, of course, because it influences politicians, it influences votes, and it influences public policy. And that fear is, of course, also a big pressure maker for politicians.
Right. So do you think that, because you mentioned that the perception right now in Canada has changed a little bit.
And I haven't seen the polling on that. Yeah. So maybe it's still, skepticism is there. But I think with the Trudeau government coming in, there's been more goodwill again. Mm-hmm. Again, I haven't seen the polls. So this is the total disclaimer. This is my impressionistic. But I would think you would probably find that confirmed if you did look.
Okay. So speaking of the perception, I think, Jen, you can clearly link it to the next question.
So I was just, especially since now there's a transition of how people are feeling on their perception.
We hope.
What is your, I guess, overall opinion on how Canada initially responded to the Syrian refugee crisis and like how it is now?
There are, of course, multiple layers to the Canadian response. There's the two governments, right? So there's the previous Harper government's response, and then there's the current government's response. And then we could talk about it from a humanitarian angle. We could talk about it from a how many bodies have crossed the ocean and come over here angle. And again, I guess in terms of resettlement initiatives, anything else that is going on. I would think that the perception from the European side is that Canada has been surprisingly slow. that Canada's taken a lot fewer people than it has historically. In the 70s, there was the Vietnam War, of course also in the 60s, right? So that was what made Canada famous, I think, around the world in terms of resettlement. So if you compare just raw numbers, the raw numbers, the 25,000 that the Trudeau government promised to bring over, it was hard to get the 25,000, as you probably know. So maybe that was already a good enough target for Canada, but the Europeans are of course all saying, oh well, you know, Canada's not doing enough because they're not moving enough bodies across the Atlantic. But of course, then you can talk about the military side, and the question there is, has Canada done enough in terms of leadership, and can Canada do enough in that area? I'm not the expert on that, but I think it's important to also think about how you can solve the conflict in the region, because that's also the international conversation, right? You're not just able to focus on the humanitarian situation, you should also focus on solving the conflict in the region. And my hands are drawing the region because I always talk with my hands, right? If you don't resolve this, then it's just going to keep going. And because everybody knows that it's complex. So the question is, has Canada done enough in lending its expertise? And is Canada a strong enough voice there to start with, right? So I think countries can always do more, right? Especially if the economy is doing well. And then the question is, what then can people do? I think just talking about it and thinking about what one might be willing to do as an individual, or perhaps in a group, or perhaps I've had students who've traveled overseas to help out, and even if you are graduate students or academics, how you can help out. I think it can not involve resources, just by shaping minds and by talking to people and just demystifying, as one of my colleagues said, some of the stuff that's sometimes just as important as the big high politics stuff about solving the crisis.
How would you... Okay, so obviously you are for helping refugees, and I would imagine more so than we have been. For people who are not for that and for against that, what would you say to like maybe convince them that they should be doing more?
There are some academics that have done really interesting work in trying to make economic arguments about this, and so by economic arguments, I mean talking about the economic contribution that people make once they come to your country. So that is an argument that, of course, you have to make sure that everybody is well enough, but any country needs immigrants. So there is that classic economic argument, and it doesn't really matter, again, looking at studies of the Vietnamese community, how they came, you're doing a good thing, but you're also bringing people into your country who will be so grateful and so determined. And if you look at a lot of studies on integration and on the need, especially for all the older societies to rejuvenate themselves, the birth rate goes down. These are some of the classic arguments that you see in the immigration literature. So you need immigrants anyway. You're doing a good thing. And the keys to integration are really determination to succeed, to want to do well, to want to give back to your state. So I think you're getting yourselves a whole lot of really thankful, grateful people. And if they're able to get into the right jobs and get trained well, I think they will be the people who will be helping in the next crisis. Because there were people from the Vietnamese community who said, I'm giving back now because I've succeeded. Mm-hmm. And so I think the economic argument is one that's always counts. But then, of course, you get the counter argument. You get they cost so much. And the suspicion and the fear argument. And I think those are the harder ones. And there are studies on how much it costs to bring people in, but I find it sometimes very difficult. Some people, you have to be open to be persuaded, right? So I think we cannot always, I guess I'm always optimistic, but I think we cannot always persuade people, but sometimes just meeting somebody who is maybe defying the stereotypes or who is different, just breaking down the barriers on a one-to-one level, if that person is open to that, perhaps that at least gets them thinking, right? And I think that one-on-one can often make a big difference. Again, there are always people in any group that we cannot persuade, and we just have to disagree. But this is also what democracy is about, right? It's about deliberation, about discussion, but it's also about thinking about how we can break down fear and give people choices, and especially give people choices in difficult situations in life. Because you would want the same for the homeless person on the street, because there was just something on the news about this initiative to give people a chance at an apartment, and they were doing studies on how mental health has gotten so much better just because people had. So again, there's evidence that if you provide people with a place to live, you subsidize that, you deal with something that some people consider a problem, putting quotation marks, listeners, on around these words, right? So it's really, I guess, also a belief in that we can all live together. And of course, yes, of course, there will always be problems. There will be people that defy the rules, that will, you know, have other opinions. And I'm not the unrealistic person who says we can never have war and people will stop hating each other. It's sad, but I think there's a one-on-one conversation that we can have. But I'm not sure if I can persuade that hardcore person who, you know, I have some people on my Facebook circle of friends who are posting stuff where I think, yes, I know this person, I know we disagree, but I'm not sure if I could persuade them. But at least if they can keep an open mind and not be voting for some of the right-wing parties and take us further down a certain direction, that's, I think, what I would hope for, because I think then it gets much harder to live together and to agree.
We are almost running out of time, and I would like to get one of these questions in. It's going to be around children and youth, since most of our listeners work with children and youth. So my question to you is, Syrian children and youth who have come from traumatic experiences are predominantly grouped together in their communities. Do you think it's a good idea for their integration as Canadians?
I was still thinking about just the trauma aspect of it, because I have a student in this class that I'm just coming from who volunteers for the Center for Victims of Torture. And I think there's a lot of work, especially children, we always say are very resilient, they'll get over everything. But of course, it takes a certain amount of time for that to happen, and they need to have help in processing these experiences. And I think both communities are helpful. The communities that understand and where you feel safe, where you feel like you're understood, where not everything is different, but then you also need that exposure and the beginning of integration in the schools. But you need to have the support so that children can process what just happened. I'm the child of somebody who fled from one part of Germany to another and who was born in 1938, so I know that that generation of Germans, they were just told to get through it because the country had to be rebuilt, and there wasn't time taken for trauma. It was also the husbands were all missing, so then the families just had to get through it. And there's so many books written now on how that's not the right approach, so you need to pay attention to both, I think, because children are strong, but they're also vulnerable. And I think you need the community, but also the new country, so that you can have hope and support at the same time, I think.
I think it's
NGOs to support.
I think what you're saying is music to some of child and youth workers' ears right now. So it's very much in line with what I was trained in my undergrad. So I appreciate that. We are running out of time, and I do want to ask you the very last question, but since I always ask it, maybe we'll leave it for Jen to ask.
Okay, well, what we would like to hear is, what does advocacy mean to you?
I think that's a really fascinating question, because I think a lot of academics have like a split brain thing on what is advocacy. There are the people who write and talk about advocacy and who don't do so much in their personal lives, and then there are people like me who I think struggle with this because I need to find the time to actually do more. So I actually, I think this coming back from my sabbatical year, I wanted to see where I can spend my energies, because we can do it in the classroom. So of course, I remember I taught a course in another country, and one of the students there said, of course, in Germany, since I'm from there, and they said, wow, this was really engaged scholarship. So my classes are often about What's the space for advocacy, especially since I talk about law and courts and migration? Who are the groups? What are the obstacles? What are the conflicts? So education about advocacy is part of, I think, all of my classes, and talking about opportunities for being engaged active citizens. But then on my personal self, I'm trying to find more spaces for me to be an advocate. I'm currently part of a group of five who is involved with waiting for a family of Syrian refugees to come, but I got relatively late on the train, but I would love to do more. The question is just, can I please clone myself so that I can be more active? I know that's also an excuse, but I think we can all challenge ourselves to just see where else we can do something else. And I think, yeah, a lot of people feel like they're not doing enough. Mm-hmm. But I also like to always encourage students to not be afraid and to always think about what their opinion is, but then also how they back it up and how difficult it is to persuade each other shouldn't deter us from trying to talk and to be advocating for a cause that we believe in.
I think that's you've made some awesome points, and I like how you've said, knowing the space for advocacy, what space that is. And I think with both of our careers in social justice and advocacy, I think we appreciate an answer like that. I don't think we've gotten that on the show yet. So thank you for saying that. We are nearly at the end of the show, and we do have to wrap up. Would you like to say anything before we end this conversation?
I would like to thank you for the opportunity, and I'm definitely going to put your podcast on my to-listen list now, because I know I was already going to do that, and now it's going to be I'm looking forward to hearing future episodes. So thank you for asking me to be on the show.
Oh, thank you for taking the time out to speak with both of us. Your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. Thank you again for speaking with us. It was a great conversation. I know I learned a lot.
Definitely have to.
If you are a child or youth that would like to be on the show, or if you have any ideas of what topics we should be talking about, please email myself or Jen at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That's yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.